Seneca 11, the Consolatio ad Helviam Matrem, a consolation to my mother Helvia. Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. In the immediately previous podcast, we learned how Seneca's fortunes took a dramatic turn for the better when he was recalled from his 8-year exile on Corsica. The stroke of good fortune occurred when Messalina committed one extramarital outrage too many, thereby forcing Claudius, with some help from his freedmen, to be rid of her once and for all. Her enforced suicide left the position of empress vacant, a job which, after a decently observed interlude, was offered to Agrippina, Claudius's niece. She also happened to be a long-term associate of Seneca's, and, as we've heard in previous podcasts, they probably had form where it came to political collusion. So this podcast will take a look at a second work that Seneca is known to have written whilst in exile on Corsica. It's another consolatio, or consolation to a bereaved party, but it's quite extraordinary in that the deceased, in inverted commas, individual is none other than the very much alive Seneca himself, and the bereaved party is his own mother, Helvia. In other words, it's a condolence piece about somebody who is still alive. It's called the Consolatio ad Helviam Matrem, or the Consolation to My Mother Helvia, and there is absolutely nothing else like it in the literature up until Seneca's time. And that very uniqueness makes its reported intent, you know, Seneca wanting to soothe his dear old mum's cares and tell her that her darling boy is doing okay on that terrible rock Corsica, highly suspect, and it sets the alarm bells ringing in my head. So what on earth is this bizarre and haunting work really all about? And what is Seneca up to underneath the surface words? I think I can explain it. First though, it's worth reminding ourselves that the consolation genre was a high literary art form. Unlike today, these consolationes, despite being dedicated to just one person, were written with the intention that they'd be widely circulated and read. We've heard in previous podcasts how Seneca used the peculiarities of this literary genre to achieve his own personal ends, or he'd at least tried to. The Consolation to Marcia, written somewhere between AD 37 to 39, and addressed to a woman whose unremarkable son had died several years previously, but whose high-profile father's books had just been republished, was a broadcast of allegiance to the then Emperor Caligula and the other children of Germanicus. The Consolation to Polybius, a freedman's secretary of Claudius on the death of a brother, written around late AD 43 or early AD 44, was a thinly veiled attempt to obtain a recall from exile from an emperor who was in the first flush of his British triumph. Both previous consolationes, then, were attempts at some form of remote psychoengineering geared at making life more bearable for Seneca himself. We can cut him some slack by remarking that on a surface level, each of the earlier works could be read as a genuine attempt to console the bereaved. But it's impossible to avoid the reality that, in writing both of them, Seneca was ultimately out for himself, and the consolation to Helvia, his own mother, was no different. Ultimately, I think that Seneca thought he could use the supposedly non-political consolatio genre as a literary stealth bomber, handy to get his real message under the radar of any censorship obstacles that might otherwise have blocked his intent. But the disastrous consolation to Polybius, in which Seneca had all but openly begged Claudius to bring him back to Rome, had taught him a harsh lesson. The short time in which he'd had to grab the fleeting window of opportunity may have been a factor in that particular consolation's clumsiness, but it did make Seneca realise that he'd have to be a lot more subtle in the future. And then in AD 48, everything suddenly changed overnight. Messalina had overstepped the mark and she was now dead. Although Claudius at first professed that he would not remarry, he fully understood that the damage Messalina had caused to the imperial household and to its reputation had to be put right. The names of a few replacement empresses were bandied about, Agrippina's among them. However, reading between the lines, I would suggest that the elevation of Agrippina above the other candidates was pretty much a foregone conclusion. Agrippina must have known she was the front runner for the vacant job as empress. Nobody wanted another Messalina. And the law on incest that was passed with such alacrity in the Senate to allow Claudius, an uncle, to marry his niece Agrippina, tells me that Agrippina must have known she had a majority faction on her side among the Romans that mattered. She was respectable, she was intelligent, she understood the decorum expected of her as Claudius's consort, and, best of all, she was the daughter of the emperor's still universally revered brother, the late Germanicus. So, if Agrippina knew the title of empress was pretty much hers already, she must have planned ahead. Her son, the boy who was to become the Emperor Nero, would be adopted by Claudius, and it's extremely probable that even at that point in time, Agrippina's ambitions were not just for herself, but also for her son. Nero's adoption into the imperial household would be a potential complication, because it was by no means a foregone conclusion that Britannicus, Claudius's natural son by Messalina, would automatically succeed to the throne. The Julio-Claudian dynasty had long operated on the heir, a pair, and a spare approach to succession, an insurance policy against premature death, unsuitability, or just downright skullduggery and treason. Agrippina probably hoped one day that if Nero became emperor, that she, as the boy's mother, could operate as some kind of regent, a power behind the throne, as it were. But such high aspirations needed to be kept under wraps while Claudius was still head of state. So Agrippina needed people around her she could trust, people who owed her, people who were already indebted to her. And she also needed a tutor for her son. Seneca fitted both briefs, and Agrippina wanted him by her side. Sure, there were probably other just as learned potential tutors in Rome, but Seneca had the added attraction of having been away from the city in exile since pretty much the beginning of Claudius's reign, and he would not have had the opportunity to form close alliances with any of the factions already operating around the Senate or Emperor. As I mentioned earlier, it's highly probable that Agrippina and Seneca had collaborated politically before, particularly during the reign of Caligula, and she knew that Seneca was somebody she could trust. Agrippina was fully aware that she would face opposition and danger when she became empress, and she badly needed somebody like Seneca on Team Germanicus. And it was at this point, I believe, that is, after Messalina was safely in her grave, but before Agrippina's official elevation to empress, that she gave Seneca the nod. The whole situation in Rome was still pretty fragile and fluid, so she would have advised him to be careful. She would have told him what and what not to say and do if he were to obtain a recall to the capital. In short, she would have told him to advertise himself, to demonstrate openly that he was no threat to Claudius or to anyone else, and that he had the qualifications to do what would be asked of him. Seneca's answer at this crucial and fragile nexus was to write the Consolatio ad Helviam Matrem, and I reckon that that work, he's got Agrippina's hands all over it. So let's start by remembering that Seneca, in AD 48, was still smarting under two humiliations. The most recent was the abject failure of his cringeworthy attempt to flatter his way back into Claudius's favour with the consolation to Polybius back in AD 44. But the biggest stigma attached to him was his alleged involvement in the adultery charge that had got him and Julia Livilla exiled back in AD 41. If Seneca had any hope of becoming attached to the royal household as tutor, he would have to unequivocally announce where he stood on the matter of marital fidelity and womanly virtue. Seneca, in other words, would have to convince everyone in Rome that he was either A, innocent of that original charge, or at the very least B, persuade them that he was a changed man. And he'd have to do it really, really well, because he'd have to bring himself into alignment with Agrippina's campaign to become empress, and she was promoting herself as the very paradigm of womanly virtue, the absolute polar opposite of her predecessor, and a definite upgrade on the morally bankrupt Messalina. There's actually no way of knowing exactly when the consolation to Helvia was written, other than the obvious fact that Seneca was still in exile on Corsica. There are no other chronological signposts in the text, so we have to go on the themes that Seneca addresses and work out which external circumstances they would best fit. The work must have been written after the consolation to Polybius, because to have written about how Seneca had come to terms with his exile, as he does in the consolation to his mother, and then write such an openly begging grovel to Claudius via Polybius, would have made him look absurd. Similarly, to have written another consolation too soon after the Polybius debacle would have seemed highly suspect, and Messalina, until her death, was probably still watching Seneca like a hawk. So bear with me and let's take a closer look at Seneca's consolation to his mother Helvia, and let's see if we can fit the events of AD 48 to its themes. I suppose the obvious questions that jump out at us are, firstly, why did Seneca address the Consolatio ad Helviam to his mother? And secondly, and more bizarrely, why is Seneca trying to console her about himself when he is clearly still alive? As a concept, it's certainly an attention grabber. It's marketing. And, in my opinion, that's precisely what this unique approach was all about. Within the first few paragraphs, Seneca tells his audience how singular his work is. I unrolled all the works that the most famous writers had composed for the purpose of repressing and controlling sorrow, he writes, and I did not discover a single example where the consoler was himself being lamented by his dear ones, Well, I'll bet he didn't. This is Seneca broadcasting his cleverness and reading. This is Seneca setting himself apart from other would-be applicants for the position tutoring Agrippina's son. This is Seneca applying for a job. And the reason he singled his own mother out as the addressee? Because she, like Agrippina, but crucially, totally unlike Messalina, was an absolute model of female Roman virtue. In other words, Seneca is, in a way, using his own mother as a stooge. It would be absurd to suggest that this communication to her, this consolation, came out of the blue as an impromptu act of kindness from an exiled son to soothe the worries of his dear old mum. She was only a few days' sail away in the Spanish province of Baetica, for crying out loud, and it's not as if Seneca was forbidden to communicate, or how else would he have got the consolation to Polybius published in AD 43 or 44? No, Seneca would have been in constant touch with his mother by messenger and courier, as he would have been, I imagine, with Agrippina, so there was no real need for a book on condolence. The other big giveaway for when this consolation was written is its constant harping on about female Roman virtue and marital fidelity. Impudicitia, or unchastity, is slammed by Seneca in this work, and he almost, but not quite, overcooks the cake with it, because he revisits the topic over and over again throughout the work. Immediately after the opening couple of passages, Seneca extols the Stoic heroism of his mother. How her mother died during childbirth, and how she lost other loved ones, her brother-in-law, her husband, even three grandchildren, including Seneca's own son. Allusions to old-fashioned values pepper the consolation, but it rises to a crescendo of approving rhetoric towards the end, where Seneca positively drools over the exemplary behaviour of his own aunt during her stay in Egypt as wife of that country's Roman procurator. The aunt is portrayed as a heroic and yet demure figure, staunch, upright, faithful, her reputation wholly beyond reproach, and always, always there, standing as the perfect backdrop to her politician husband. Now, who do we know who is pushing for that same kind of status? Well, Agrippina, of course. This is Seneca reminding his readership of the qualities required for the next empress. He's been banging on about them all through the book, and while they describe Agrippina to a T, they also throw their opposite, the late Messalina, into sharp relief. And it has the added benefit of inferring that Seneca himself approves wholeheartedly of marital good behaviour, and that's an impression he badly needed to promote given the allegations of adultery that had been clinging to him like mud. The consolation to Helvia is often beautifully written. It's a definite step up on the rushed and awkward consolation to Polybium. Seneca, probably prepped well in advance by Agrippina, had much more time to think about this one and more time to get his tone just right. In addition to promoting Agrippina through the role models of his mother and aunt, Seneca also had to prove his credentials as a philosopher slash tutor. He carries this off by including passages about how he has read the great works and authors and has arrived at an equanimity of mind where his exile is no longer of any real concern to him. He even, in an attempt to prove that he will be no threat to anybody, states that the trappings of fame, money, office, influence, those are the words he uses, no longer hold any appeal to him, and then he caps the whole lot off with a textbook stoic philosophical diatribe about the false trappings of luxury. The whole tone is designed to pass Seneca himself off as somebody who, if allowed back into the fold, is going to be very unambitious, keep a very low profile, and not be any trouble to anyone. After all, he goes on to point out, weren't some of Rome's greatest servants of the state from the past men of moderate means and needs? But it's the theme of impudicitia, unchastity, that Seneca returns to most often, and he repeatedly manages to tie in that theme with the subject of false accusations and miscarriages of justice. And he brings up the famous examples of the Greek Socrates and Aristides and the Roman Marcus Cato before returning once again to a catalogue of his own mother's virtues. And in yet another attempt to distance himself from the stigma of adultery, and in what can only be yet another shot at the late and unlamented Messalina, Seneca describes unchastity as the maximum saeculi malum, the greatest evil of the age. And why is that a shot at Messalina? Because it comes immediately after a passage in which Seneca laments that the downfall, which was his arrest and subsequent exile back in AD 41, happened so fast that, at the time, he didn't even have time to inform his own mother what was going on. And Seneca didn't stop there. He doesn't leave a stone unturned trying to prove that the contemporary rampant loose morality, with its indolence, its duels and pearls and extramarital shenanigans, stand in direct contrast to the mores maiorum, the old-fashioned values of the Roman ancestors. This is a direct goad to the conscience of the Roman people. You've had a Messalina, he's saying, and look where that got you. It's time for some good old-fashioned decorum, and if that's what's needed, then you can't go past Agrippina. Oh, and by the way, not only am I a bloody good philosopher, but I can't be having with all that adultery lark at all. So what does the consolatio ad Helvia matrem, the consolation to my mother Helvia, tell us? How can we sum up what Seneca was trying to achieve? Well, for a start, in my opinion, the use of his mother as addressee served a double purpose. Helvia was the type of Roman woman who was universally admired, as was Seneca's aunt, and his portrayal of them was designed to make people contrast that high standard with the depravity of Messalina. Helvia and the aunt were Roman matrons of the old school, products of the strict morality and marital behavioural guidelines that had epitomised the principate of the late Augustus, and this was meant to direct people's thinking to the excellent reputation of Augustus's great-granddaughter, Agrippina. In addition, Seneca could, by association with his two models of female uprightness, insinuate into people's minds that he, as a man of strong principles, was either innocent of the charge of adultery that had got him exiled, or at least that he was now a changed man. The consolation to Helvia was also a bit of an insurance policy for Seneca. He knew that Agrippina was going to put in a plug for him if and when she became empress, so he had to promote marital fidelity, that is pudicitia, and that's why he kept banging on about it. Agrippina would have to sell Seneca to Claudius. She would have to persuade Claudius that Seneca was not going to be any type of threat. He would, after all, be put in charge of the education of a possible heir to the throne. She would have to convince the emperor that Seneca reviled the behaviour of Messalina and all she stood for, and she could use the consolation to Helvia to help prove her case. We have to remember that Claudius had only rid himself of Messalina when she went too far and jeopardized the stability of the state, and even then it took the intervention of his freedmen to finally make the problem go away. Agrippina probably advised Seneca to play on this when writing his consolation. It was something she could point out to Claudius when advocating for Seneca's recall. And the constant reminders in Seneca's work about false accusations were likely also included on Agrippina's advice. Claudius probably knew that Seneca was not guilty of the adultery charge that had got him exiled, and had even stood up in the Senate to have the sentence mitigated from execution to exile. So it's possible that Agrippina had Seneca apply a bit of a guilt trip, which she could again use in her favour to get Seneca back to Rome. In a nutshell, what Seneca's consolation to Helvia was proclaiming, probably at Agrippina's prompting, was this: I've grown up. I've learned my lesson. I've studied philosophy, lots of it. Your newly adopted son will need philosophy. Agrippina trusts me. I can do the job. And I'm no threat. I'm in your debt for my life already. I will be even more so if you recall me from exile. I'm not going to rock the boat. Look how well I've learned my lesson about exile. This time, Seneca's consolation worked. History informs us that Agrippina was married to her uncle Claudius in early AD 49. It was a red ticket day for Lucius Annaeus Seneca. Not only was he recalled from his long exile on his barren Mediterranean rock and made a tutor in the imperial household, but he was also made a praetor, a political office one step down from the consulship. Seneca was about to experience a golden patch, and he owed it all, absolutely everything, to his patroness. So, it's now AD 49, and Seneca has obtained his heart's desire and is finally back in Rome, the centre of the ancient world. In those heady days, Seneca was Agrippina's animal. But for how long could his loyalty be relied upon, even to her? So, Lucius Annaeus Seneca has come in from the wings to occupy a far more central position on the Roman stage. The ancient commentators have a lot more to say about him from here on in, but his part in what was to happen over the next few years must often be pieced together from other evidence, as his lessons had been well learned and he preferred, for the most part, to keep to the background of the great events unfolding around him. So please join me for the next podcast, which will look at the role Seneca played in the later years of Claudius's reign. And we'll also look at the games that started to be played out between the ever-shifting factions that sensed the fading power of an aging emperor. I hope to see you there.